This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Are you interested in the unknown?
Video games.
Old movies.
Horror.
Old TV.
Zombies.
Fantasies.
Comics.
The paranormal.
And science fiction.
Hot TV. Games and more. Then tune in Tuesday night at 10.
On Sci-Fi and Squid.
On Joy 94.9.
It's not personal. It's strictly business.
Two classics.
No! Run!
Two films that set new standards for motion picture excellence.
Don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again.
21 Academy nominations and 9 awards, including 2 for Best Picture.
I know it was you, Fredo.
The Godfather. And now, Paramount Pictures presents the continuation of Francis Ford Coppola and Mario Puzo's legendary saga.
This is Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. In the studio, we have Richard Sawada, Head of Film Programs at the wonderful Australian Centre for the Moving Image, also known to us as ACMI, or I call it ACME. What do you call it, Richard?
We call it ACME as well.
Do
at
you?
Work. Yes, we call it ACME. Okay. Hello, everyone.
Hello there. Excellent. Now, we're doing something a bit different for Sci-Fi and Squeam. We don't normally cover things like gangster movies and that sort of thing, but this is very special. This is the Godfather Trilogy, which will be screening from Saturday the 20th to Sunday the 28th of this month, of September 2014. You know, it's been described as a blending of a new depth with an old genre, a rarity, the mass entertainment that we all needed. 1972, after that, I don't think American film was ever quite the same. So Richard Sawada's going to tell us a bit about that. Welcome to the show.
Yes, yes, thanks for having me. Always great to talk about classic films, whether they be sci-fi genre or whatever. But yeah, it's very pleasing that we've got these films happening at the end of the month.
Right. What was the, what do you call it? What was the reason for bringing them together?
Well, we've been working on a relationship with the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in the United States, who are better known as, you know, the hosts of the Oscars. They have a huge, well, when I say huge, it's beyond huge. It's a monstrous library of films. Pretty well everything that's ever won an Oscar is part of their library, and a range of other things too that have been nominated for Oscars or have been deposited with the Academy. And in fact, they're building a huge museum there as well, which is going to be open over the next few years, but they're building it now. Anyway, with the we've been wanting to build a relationship with the Academy for quite a long time, and we've been regularly in touch with the Academy Film Archive with various things that we do. And then the opportunity came up of, look, why don't we build a regular relationship with them? Why don't we bring some of the beautiful treasures from their archive to Australian audiences on a regular basis? So we got to talking with their European representative, who now lives in Australia, who's based in Sydney, who wants to work with the Australian academicians as well, people like Adam Elliott and Baz Luhrmann and Catherine Martin and other, Jeffrey Rush. Part of the relationship idea was to engage academicians with the Academy as well. So the Academy has a very a rigorous restoration process with many of the things in their archive. And the Godfather trilogy was one that they have recently restored in conjunction with Paramount Films. And we thought, you know, what better way to start the relationship with the Academy than these magnificent films. And we'll be doing a series of films with the Academy every quarter. And this is the first one off the rank.
Well, it's something that you just could not refuse, an offer like that. Sorry, I had to slip that in.
You've been working on that all day, I know, I can tell.
I know, I was trying to figure it out.
it is an offer that you can't refuse. I mean, these films have been restored to 35mm film, the original format, not digital, you know, versions, DCP. And not that there's anything necessarily wrong with digital restorations, and many film foundations that have been strictly working with film are now working with DCP, which is the digital format. But the Academy are very, as I was saying, very rigorous in what they're wanting to do. So they restored these films to film. This is the first time in the world that these prints have moved outside of not just the United States, but outside the walls of the Academy. So they're absolutely brand new, haven't been screened anywhere, not even at the Academy.
Right.
So it is an offer that you can't refuse.
Yeah.
But they're working with so many other beautiful things and really interesting things as well. Like, for instance, they're working on a project of unreleased endings, so, you know, or alternate endings.
Oh,
so
yes.
Films that had been filmed with an alternate ending and then another ending placed on the back of the films. So they're working with restoring the old endings to do a this and that, you know.
Will the trilogy, do these films have...
These films don't, endings, although Godfather 3 is the director's cut of The Godfather.
Right.
Of Godfather 3. But, you know, films like Frank Capra's The Lost Horizon, when they first made it, have five different endings before they settled on one. And those endings have never been seen. So if these are some of the beautiful things that the Academy are doing, including The Godfather trilogy. You know, it's going to be a very... fruitful and interesting relationship that local audiences have with these magnificent works.
I mean, it's certainly signified, you know, the beginning of, well, not the beginning, but a real highlight point for kind of like independent cinema as such, even though it was a big film for its time, and I believe it made close to, well, several million even before it screened for the first time.
It did, and it had
it
a budget.
It sold like 400 cinemas before it even had its premiere.
It was a turning point. 1972, the original, the first Godfather was made. And for the time, you know, around that time, the films were starting to get bigger budgets, things like Chinatown and even more exploitation type films like Easy Rider were starting to really, you know, encompass a greater level of, you know, high level of production values and such. But this film really was something different. And it's still something different. You can still watch it today, and it was like it was made yesterday. It was made for a budget of $6.5 million, I think, US dollars, which was a big budget at the time. And but when you think about it compared to the production values, you can go, oh my God, how did they do it? And then Godfather 2, I think, was made for a budget of something like $15 million. And then Godfather Part 3, which was made in 1990, was made for a budget of $54 million. So you can see just the way the industry changed. And a big part of the way the industry changed was The Godfather. And even, you know, it's not just about the budgets. You can talk about the budgets and the production values, but you have to really, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's eye was just incredible in who he selected to be in the movie. Like, I think Robert Duvall, who, you know, is a great actor, one of Hollywood's great actors, I think it was like his fifth film performance. And Al Pacino, you know, I think it was his fourth screen performance. And to hold down such monstrous roles that went on to define not just the cinema or that kind of cinema, but the actors themselves, is just... And for Francis Ford to just go, I want you, and for it to work, and for it to work still so beautifully today, it's just a phenomenal achievement in
It is incredible.
Vision.
It is incredible. Yeah. I mean, it's those opening scenes and everything, and when you first see, of course, the wonderful Marlon Brando as Vito Corleone when you first see him, even though we used to make jokes about plums in his mouth with that accent you know, marbles in the mouth sort of thing. How many people, who hasn't tried to impersonate?
I agree. It's
Vito.
It is an iconic role.
It is,
and
isn't
I guess there's probably more, but, you know, there's the Streetcar Named Desire role, the Wild One role, and
the Waterfront
Now role, On the Waterfront.
Could have been a contender, you know.
And The Godfather. Said it. I mean, Far Out.
Incredible.
They are the great roles in cinema, and of that generation, certainly his performance in both Apocalypse
Because he
now
plays a much older person than he was in real life, too. And I mean, the makeup was, maybe by today's standards, it was, you know, they didn't have the same, obviously, makeup technology as they do today. That might have been a bit shaky. That might be something that's hasn't kept well with time.
If
but
you want to pick away
he's
at
still
the veneer,
can play
I
an old man.
Yes. Yeah, he did play. He did play.
He can still play very well.
Yeah, he did play it very well. It's very convincing. That's the beauty of that. All the films, I think, is that they are so incredibly convincing, and the performers, the performances, are unbelievably. When I say unbelievably real, it's a terrible tautology, but I mean they're just so incredibly true.
I think one of my favourite actors in there, of course, would have to be. The late and the wonderful John Cazale, who plays Fredo. I mean, such a marvellous actor, such an unattractive-looking man, but he was very, you know, he really did shine, he really stood out, and it's just such a fantastic story about a family, a dysfunctional family, basically.
That's right. I agree with you about the character of Fredo, who appeared with Al Pacino later, of course, in Dog Day Afternoon, and they performed really well together as well. But one of the things that's also fantastic to watch throughout the entire trilogy is the development of Al Pacino as a performer. You know, going from 1972 to 1990, that's a long time.
Yeah, because there's a 16-year break, isn't there?
That's right.
From the second one.
That's right. So, you know, that's a long time in an actor's life, and to see him develop through the Godfather trilogy, but also through his other roles, outside of that, is just an amazing thing to watch. And Francis Ford was pivotal in doing that for Pacino.
The interesting thing about that is there is those family connections and a type of lineage there. I mean, I'm not saying that they're related as such, but there was a lot of that within that community. Was that something that was left over from his original group? Because, I mean, he was with people like George Lucas was one of his peers, Francis Ford Coppola.
You're thinking of Spielberg and that bunch?
Yeah, that bunch all from UCLA. I mean, there was that lineage, that connection, I think, that you see. And let's face it, the two of the biggest films of the 70s, well, three of the biggest films of the 70s.
Yeah.
Godfather, 72, and of course Jaws.
Yes.
76 or 76, I think
George, I'm not sure actually.
Yeah.
77.
And Star Wars 77. Yeah. So those three guys, they all knew each other, they all worked together before, and Zoetrope, which is still existing.
Yeah,
existence.
It's still going strong,
isn't it?
It's a very diverse company, Zoetrope.
Was Sophia Coppola part of that?
Look, I'm not sure.
She was certainly
in the movie.
She was in the 1990 number three.
Was about six other Coppola relations in the Godfather films.
Pretty amazing.
But that whole Coppola family, Sophia and Gia Coppola, they're making excellent films themselves still now. But I think there was a very, I wouldn't say magical time, but that was the time of the blockbusters. It was also, when you look at the Godfather trilogy, it was probably, perhaps, arguably the invention of the franchise type movie as well. Mm. But, you know, those guys, you know, making those films at the time, it's not just them, but there's also the producers of the time as well, people like Richard Evans, and there was a fantastic documentary made about him.
Robert Evans.
Robert Evans.
Yeah.
Cool. Called The Kid Stays in the Picture.
That was
brilliant,
wonderful.
Brilliant movie.
Yeah.
So there were those people behind the scenes.
I mean,
that really...
he produced Rosemary's Baby in the 1960s.
Chinatown, I think, as well.
Another Polanski film. Yeah.
So there was that whole circle of creativity where I think, maybe I'm just drawing a long bow here, but it's, and with things like Apocalypse Now, where it's like, okay, let's just start production, and once we're into it, the studio will not be able to say no. We'll just get the momentum so big and go so far down the line they have to let us finish it.
It would have helped, I guess, that it was a top-selling book by Mario Puzo. I mean, it was a bestseller book. I think it was one of those books that every summer batch had a copy of it. You know, there was two books, I think, in that era, and it was Peter Benchley's Jaws, and it was certainly this one. Yeah. You know, The Godfather.
No, that's
true. We've all read it.
Yeah, that's true. And the
secretly.
I'd throw the Poseidon Adventure in there too. I don't know how many times I read the Poseidon Adventure when I was a teenager.
Right.
But maybe that's just being a teenager rather than anything of enormous literary value. But you're right. It did have that huge thing behind it. But then when you look at, you know, that doesn't always translate into a good movie when you look at things like Dune and other things as well, which were monstrous books, which everyone was reading, which just completely fell apart at the box office, whether it was because the film was just badly directed or whether the studio started
just
dabbling
didn't
in things.
Understand David Lynch as art.
but the films really are a sign of the times, but not confined to the times. You know, they really do still work well today. And when you look at those other films like Jaws and Star Wars and, you know, Chinatown and Rosemary's Baby and so many things from that period as well, I mean, they still do stand up.
They do. And this is the amazing thing.
It is. It's great vision.
Which, in many ways, you can't actually really say that so much with films from the 80s and 90s, I don't think. Because that seems to be more of a obsession with fashion, I think. Fashion is the franchise, but...
Yeah. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the performances or the direction or the scripts or just the period, you know, the state of mind of everyone in that period, you know?
I would suggest that perhaps it was because it was a time in the 70s. There was, you know, they'd had a type of recession. There was the oil crisis for the US, in any case.
Yeah.
That had the Nixon era, Vietnam War. I think there was a lot of stress, a lot of strife going on, and it seemed to funnel through and come out in these films. So I think a lot of them, if you look at a lot of the films, apart from Jaws, they're not really set in the 70s as such.
No.
They don't have that sense that they are, even though when we watch them now, we know, we see all the telltale signs of that. I mean, obviously, Martin Scorsese's brilliant at putting things in time with things like the Taxi Driver. But you don't get a feeling, you get a feeling that they want to say something about the 70s, but they don't want to say it in the time that they're in. apart from School CC, and maybe that's why it's lasted so well.
Yeah,
you know,
perhaps so. Yeah, I don't know. They are very truthful themes, you know, the dysfunctional family, and you know, it doesn't have to be about the time, because of course things like The Godfather keep going backward in time. You know, they go to earlier days,
of course,
so you have that period piece.
Kind like of number type two, thing. Okay, I guess that brings us to The Godfather 2. Of course, who else would you have in there? You've got Al Pacino. You've got to have the other one, Robert De Niro.
You do got to have the other one.
And they did, and it was so clever, and it worked so well. But it's probably the lesser screened or lesser seen of the three, would you say?
I reckon probably number three is the lesser seen of them all. The Godfather 2, I mean, it's so long. It's such an incredibly long movie. Like, it clocks in at 200 minutes. 3.5 hours, that's long. Even, you know, by classic standards, that's long. So if you're talking about a lesser screened movie, that would be one of the reasons why. It's certainly
because
not
of
because
length.
Of the quality. I mean, if you're running a cinema, that's three screenings.
And this is just 2 years later, too. It's remarkable that they managed to film something like that. Do you know if they were filming... I know how Peter Jackson does films now. Do you know if they were filming, when they did Godfather 1, that they were filming bits of Godfather 2?
Look, I don't know about that. There may very well be quite a good amount of pickups and second unit material, things that didn't get into the first feature that might have made its way into the second one. I don't know that kind of detail. It wouldn't surprise me if it did.
It got Best Picture too, which was extraordinary at the time.
It was. But again, it was a highly anticipated film. You would have to think, with something running that long, coming out so soon after The Godfather Part 1, that the wheels were already in motion for the second one.
Yeah, which, I mean, is interesting that we didn't get Godfather Part 3 before the end of the decade.
I know, that was a long time.
That's a long time. Was there any that you know of, any reason why that...
I don't know. I'd take a stab and say that would be the studio saying, we've had two monster films, let's just see how much we can squeeze out of the third.
Yeah.
So that's what my logic says. I could be completely wrong there, but that could very well be the reason why.
Yeah. I mean, both of these films are highly influential, of course, particularly 1 and 2, probably more so as far as the gangster genre goes. And I believe the American Film Institute ranked it... number two as the 32nd greatest film in American history. Kept that rank for 10 years, which is quite amazing.
Well, it depends who what list you look at, because the Hollywood Reporter list and the Internet Movie Database put The Godfather 1 at number one.
Mm-hmm.
And they also put The Godfather 2 at something like number 8 or number 9.
Right. So Godfather 1 is number one.
Yeah.
And why did they do that? I mean...
Why would you?
I can think of why, but
I'm just
wondering why.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? It is such a... When you look at the influence, like, I guess
it's American.
You would say
it's it really is the ultimate American story.
It is a big American tale,
isn't it? Because A, it's about immigration. B, it is about a family, obviously. And C, it's about crime.
That's right. It's
I'm not saying that that's what it says about American culture, but certainly... it's that American dream, isn't it?
It is. It wraps in that whole mythology of the 30s and Al Capone and all that kind of thing, which, like with Australians with Ned Kelly, you know, really revel in and despite its illegality, I guess, or morality.
The flaws, exactly. Now, just thinking of scenes in the films, what would be, for Godfather 1, what are your favourite? Do you have a favourite scene?
It's for those of you who haven't seen it, I won't say what my favourite scene is. It happens at a toll booth.
And it's
a pivotal point in the movie, which absolutely flips the whole family. And it flips the whole family. The fantastic famous scenes of, Marlon Brando with a cat on his lap, you know, doing...
Yes.
Being the, you know, just being the Godfather.
Strangelove.
Yeah. It's really great. I mean, it's everything that defined a mafia movie. That scene. All you have to do is just say The Godfather, and that's what people think of, you know. of Vito Corleone in his office.
But the opening, doing the opening scenes are probably my favourite, setting up a story. The wedding, you know, it's set in a wedding. I'm not spoiling it too much if you haven't seen it, but it's set in a wedding, and it's like in those sort of arrangement, you know, sort of scenes. Everything comes together. All the characters are introduced, pretty much. You can see the dynamics happening without giving away too much. And those interactions are going on, playing at different parts of a house and a backyard where a wedding's going on. So it's an intimate sort of scenes are happening.
Yeah.
It's an incredible first, 20 minutes.
It is, it is.
Incredible.
Yeah,
it's probably for me... Yeah, after one of the scenes, I think the other one that it reminds me of is, again, gangster movies, speaking of gangster movies, is Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas.
Yeah.
The restaurant scene. It's very similar.
Yeah.
Because you're bringing it all together and learning about little bits about the characters,
that's true.
The main players.
There's an excellent restaurant scene, of course, in The Godfather. You can't not have an Italian restaurant scene with Michael Corleone, Al Pacino, where he has to basically become a man, you know, where he has to take on some serious family business.
Yes.
And that's also the moment that completely flips him.
Yeah.
And that is so beautifully done, the sound. When you really, you know, separate out the elements of that sequence, the sound and the editing is just, you know, it's incredible. And it builds to a level that, you know, is almost unbearable, certainly in the cinema. So those moments like that are really, there's not many words, but there's a lot of really great action.
Yeah. Do you consider this one of the most violent films? Number one?
Not really. When you look at it against something like Scarface,
yes,
it's not. But for audiences of the time, it was certainly really
confronting.
Yeah, it was very brutal. Which was one of the interesting things I think about the film as well, is that it is so incredibly brutal, and it does have many dashes of Sam Peckinpah in there. You know, The Wild Bunch and Bonnie and Clyde and all that sort of thing. So it does have a lot of that stuff in there. But there is such high art and such great sophistication in the composition of the film, of every shot, and such great clarity with everything. I mean, I don't know how to say this, but it is such a clear film. The lines are so sharp and the colour is so bright and the design of the costumes is so clean. Everything has just got such an incredible sharpness about it, which is high design and high art against incredible brutality and, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, you know, Al Capone, 1930s genre crime. You know, it's really, it's a very respectful movie, but also a very, very sophisticated film.
So let's talk about the screenings of them at Acme. A very small duration of time, but are you expecting people to get excited about it?
Well, looking at the way the pre-sales are going, they are already excited.
Yeah.
We're certainly excited about it at Acme, quite aside from the films, because for us, the films are not just getting them on the screen and that sort of thing. The films are getting them here. And with the Godfather trilogy, there's about 20 trunks of films up in the projection room at moment. For us, it's an artifact, and we're excited just to have the artifact in the building.
So this is the real difference from most cinema now.
That's right.
People download and send through their examples or their trailers and their films.
Well, that's right.
This way. Now, how did these? I'm really curious. How did these turn up? How was that?
Well, they come in like 25 kilo trunks. Each trunk of film is 25 kilos. So the film, each trunk has got like two spools of film in it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes three, and each spool runs for about 20 minutes. So when you're looking at like just one film that's running 3.5 hours,
yes.
You can do the maths as to how many reels of film there is. And what happens as well, like when I say the old days, like 2 years ago in cinemas when films were running from platter systems, which is like a big donut, you join all the film together and you put on a big donut and then it runs as a continual loop through the projector and back onto another donut. That was the traditional way of showing films. with these films, we have to show them archivally, which means that we have two projectors in the projection room, and we have one 20-minute spool on one projector, and we have the next 20-minute spool on the next projector. So when one 20-minute spool finishes and you see the little dots in the top of the screen, we click over to the next projector, take that spool off, the finished spool off, and put another one on. So for us, for the projection, it's very labour-intensive, and there's probably, I'll take a stab and say there's maybe 6 or 8 changeovers with each film, and you have to time it to the second. You know, it's not something that you can go away and have a ciggy and hope that it's going to hit the screen.
So the projectionists, did you have to bring someone in especially or train them?
No, our ACME projectionists are trained we do a lot of that. And the more rare actual film becomes, the more skilled the operators have to be, and the more we have to run in that archival way. It's called archival screening, so the more we have to run in that archival way.
Wow.
So for us, it's really exciting, and for the projectionists, it's incredibly exciting. And looking at the way tickets have been selling, for audience, it seems to be incredibly exciting too.
Wow. That is a big feat. That's an endurance, that is.
It is. It is.
Very old school.
But it totally connects us. It was just one of the beautiful things about working in the industry that we work in, is that we're not just connected to, let's get this film, it's really good, we love it, and let's show it to audiences. We're actually kind of, well, I feel actually connected to the history of the film. You know, we are part, this is the first time this film is, this actual physical film has been screened, ever. So for me, that's kind of like, it's a strange kind of marriage, that wherever this film goes, no one will know, but wherever this film goes, I'll know what, that I'm connected to it in some way, in a very personal way, aside from just loving the movie.
Amazing. And 40 plus years later, it still has such resonance, and the franchise itself still has the power to
It is incredibly powerful.
And captures those dreams, the American dream. But
it does, it wraps in a lot. And, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, you know, he's a genius. And this was his, the pinnacle, this and Apocalypse Now, of course, were the highest points, not just in his career, but in cinema, full stop.
Now, do we know, does he do a lot of film work now? I don't think he...
With Francis?
Yes.
Look, I don't know. Zoetrope still operates.
Yes.
It operates in a variety of ways, and his family are very heavily involved in the studio. So I think it probably has, you know, he's like Vito Corleone. He's sitting at the
top.
He is
the godfather.
and the family are running the business and producing some excellent Oscar-winning films.
Exactly.
And I know with the Gia Coppola film that James Franco wrote, Palo Alto, you know, he is part of that film as a voice, but also in a production capacity. So... So I think there was probably a bit of that. But the deeper involvement of Coppola, I don't really know.
Probably doesn't need to.
But why would you?
He's built this empire and, you know, it's fine. I wonder if he sits in a chair stroking a cat. I don't know, but I can imagine it.
I can too.
It's great to know that this is available and it's going to be screening here. Will it go anywhere else in Australia, or just you guys?
No, this is it. Certainly, with this version of the films, this is the only stop in Australia for it, and probably one of the only stops in the world. Screening archivally, like we do in Australia, there is probably 2 cinemas that can do it across the entire country.
Wow!
And more in the United States, but they're a dying breed.
Right, fantastic. Now, will there be others that you're going to be doing these archival screenings in the future?
We're working, ideas? With the Academy, like we do archival screenings at ACME regularly.
Yeah, you've done a few actually, haven't you? I missed the one with, the Silo and the...
The Pasolini films. Right. There is, the Cinematheque does a lot of archival films. We do a lot as well. But in terms of the relationship with the Academy, our next instalment will be in February sometime. Mm-hmm. We're still working out what titles we'll be screening with them. We work with them in terms of what they feel is a priority for them to screen, or for us to screen, you know, things that they feel are the big highlight works that they've been restoring. So that'll be February, and I think we'll be in probably announcing that in December-ish as to what that will be. But I really want to do the alternate endings. I think that's a really great idea. I'd love to see the five versions of Lost Horizon.
What, watch the whole movie?
No, I reckon you watch the movie once and then watch the endings. But it can be such a great interactive experience as well. You know, get people to vote on what
exactly
they feel is the better ending.
Yeah, because there's those trailer festivals where people watch trailers and judge trailers.
Just
the trailers sometimes are better than the film.
Making of trailers is an art in itself.
It really is. True. And there are trailers that include film footage that's not in anywhere.
That's correct.
In some of the films. So they stand alone.
And some of the famous filmmakers, like particularly in the cult and the genre kind of type sphere, like Joe Dante and such, you know, that's how they started. They cut trailers. And Australian filmmakers like Jamie Blanks, that's what he did, is cut trailers just in his own time for the fun of it, and sent the trailers into studios to say, hey, look, see, here's what I can do.
How about
a job, you know?
I think, did you see Electric Boogaloo, the story?
I haven't seen Electric Boogaloo.
Okay, yes. Interesting about trailers that were created without a film, and sometimes the film wouldn't be made. The idea of the trailer was to sell a film project that may not be made. But
well, that's very true. It happens all the time, still, that old flim-flammery. When you go to Cannes, when you go to the Cannes Film Festival, I've been there four times, and the market, they have a huge market there. It's on four floors in three different buildings and on the beach and all over the place.
Yeah.
And you would say that probably, I'd take a stab and say 85% of the films in the marketplace are not made. All there is a poster.
Never see them. That's it. Yeah, a poster, just maybe a trailer if they can afford it.
That's right. Just a poster.
That's excellent. You know,
it's funny.
It is gorgeous. All right. Well, I would love to see the Star Wars trilogy, but there are issues concerning a certain person. So we may not see that ever happen. As far as a 35mm print.
Oh, as far as the print goes, I doubt we'll ever see that happen.
I doubt it. Apparently he won't give up the original prints to the Smithsonian even, so
that even doesn't surprise
heritage,
me.
Supposed to be heritage
at print. Least he maintains, at least he has the prints. There are many filmmakers, not distributors, but studios.
When he gets angry at fans, when he gets a little bit testy, he talks about destroying them. But
you couldn't possibly. You just couldn't.
Arrested. No.
You couldn't.
Oh, well, look. Richard, it's been wonderful speaking to you.
No,
Richard
pleasure.
Richard Sawada from Acme, about something we don't normally do in Sci-Fi and Screen, gangsters. But, I can see the connection. There's a connection between, obviously, the brutality. Certainly there's some horror in there. And I think people will be satiated. It'll whet their appetite for more. And they'll want to see all three. And they'll probably want to see them again.
I hope so.
Straight afterwards. So if they can tolerate 3.5 hours, is it for number two?
Number two is 3.5 hours. Number one is 3 hours.
Will there be breaks for the number two?
No. We'll just torture the audience as much as we possibly can.
Well, that's not
fair. I think there will be breaks.
Be breaks and choc tops, perhaps. Yeah. I don't know. Well, it's fantastic. I wish you all the best of luck. It starts this Saturday the 20th, runs to Sunday the 28th here in Melbourne town. It's at the ACMI. We'll put all the links on the Facebook page for Sci-Fi and Squeam. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
I betrayed my wife. I betrayed myself. I killed men. And I ordered men to be killed. I ordered the death of my brother. He injured me. I killed my mother's son. I killed my father's son. We've sold the casinos. All businesses having to do with gambling. We have no interests or investments in anything illegitimate.
Don Corleone. The Corleone family. Partners with the Pope. They may cry blasphemy.
This is business.
I know you're into banks and Wall Street, but everyone knows you're the final worry, like the Supreme Court. All I want to do is protect you from these guys, and your lawyers can't do that. I said we make them dead. You give me the order, I'll take care of it.
I command this family, right or wrong.
You know, Michael, now that you're so respectable, I think you're more dangerous than you ever were.
Our true enemy has not yet shown his face. If every drug pusher in this room were to drop dead, I would be the only one alive.
Well, you tell him for me, he can live or he can die, you understand?
Will you shut up? Will you shut up?
Do you love me? You're the only one left in this family with my father's strength.
I'm a Corleone.
You can save the Corleone family. I'll help you.
The ultimate story of family.
Come at me as you will.
And loyalty.
Give up her daughter.
Power. And violence.
Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
The Godfather, Part 3.
When they come, they'll come at what you love.
Here comes a candle to light your bed, and here comes a chopper to chop off your head. Good night, folks, and if you're not decapitated, remember to tune in next time for Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.